I actually turned around to Sean Ryan Phillips and said, what do I do? And he said, just run around a lot. So I did that and fouled everyone that I could. So I'm doing a catwalk in Milan at Giorgio Armani's house. When I got to the other end, there's a guy there with a six pack. He was chiseled. And I thought, I need some of them. So I was the least modelly looking model there. I broke my nose, and the question was, do I miss England to get my nose fixed, or do I play for England and don't do any modelling anymore?
You were not a Steve McLaren fan, were you?
No, not at all.
You know, you were nicknamed Calamity James. You must have had to have very broad shoulders or thick skin to accept criticism like that.
I was crying out for help, even though I didn't realise at the time.
Hello and welcome to the Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG. Now, my guest today is, I think, one of the most distinctive, recognisable figures from football in the past decades, really. He played in goal from some of England's biggest clubs, Liverpool and Manchester City, Aston Villa, West Ham, all amongst them. He won more than 50 England caps, and yet throughout his career, he still had his critics. Well, he's here to answer them now, so my guest today is David James. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Look, I mentioned, obviously, goalkeeping is going to predominate the conversation. But I mentioned playing in goal, but the first picture I've got, actually, is of something a bit special. Because it's you in action, and you are not in goal.
Hmm.
You are playing as a striker just for Manchester City.
Hmm.
Yeah, tell us how that happened.
Okay, so we're playing last game of season. I think it was 2005. I should know all this information, but I, the date has left me. 2005, I think it was. Playing Middlesbrough, last game of season at the Etihad, or Eastlands, as it was called. We were 3 points behind Middlesbrough. A win would have put us above them, and we would have qualified for Europe. Little did I know that at 1-1 with, what I think it was 7 minutes left, I looked over to the touchline and Nicky Weaver stood there next to the fourth official. And I thought, what have I done wrong? And all of a sudden, Claudio Reyna goes off and they hand me an outfield shirt. And yeah, I'd like to say the rest is history in a good way, but it was not quite not quite as positive as that.
Yeah. So Stuart Pearce was in charge at the time, wasn't he? Had he mentioned to you before that this might be a possibility?
No. The kit man mentioned at halftime that he had my shirt done. And I said, what are you on about? And he said, I've got your shirt done. And I'm like, Chappie, don't worry about it. I've got a game to play. And then, as I say, with 7 minutes to go, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, hang on, what's going on? I actually turned around to Sean Ryan Phillips and said, what do I do? And he said, just run around a lot. So I did that and fouled everyone that I could. So...
Had you worked on anything like this in training? Or was this just right
Jeff,
out of the blue?
Jeff, come on. Do you know what the biggest frustration is? Apart from Robbie Fowler missing the penalty, which would have given us a 2-1 win, was that I wasn't given any kind of heads up before the game. Had I known the day before, I would have been out on the training field for the next half an hour doing what outfielders do. That's like control the ball and passing it. I don't know, and even on a match day, I would have done a little bit more in the warm-up, but I didn't know anything. And anyone who's seen the video footage will contest that, you know, I didn't look like someone who knew, though, they were meant to be playing upfield.
I mean, it's impossible to imagine, isn't it, in this day and age, you know, let's look like next season, you know, if things aren't going well for City, they take Donnarumma out of goal, put him up front, put James Trafford in. It would be front-page news.
Yeah. There's a bit of irony in this because Robbie misses the penalty. And I literally didn't know till a few years ago. And Robbie said, had I scored, City would never have been sold. And even this talk of Donnarumma in your scenario would never have happened because Pep Guardiola wouldn't have become Man City manager, and everything that he did to spoil everybody else's dream in the Premier League and around Europe would never have happened. So... the fact that Robbie missed and the fact that I didn't score, I think, is probably something the Man City fans are actually now quite happy about. Yeah.
So the rest, as you say, really is history.
Mm.
I mean, you mentioned Robbie there. Obviously, one of your other clubs was Liverpool. And we'll get this out of the way straight away, because in those days, of course, you used to be termed the Spice Boys, and you and Jamie Redknapp, Steve McManaman. And you were never you were the least likely Spice Boy in the history of the world, weren't you?
I wasn't a Spice Boy. Yeah. I was married with two kids. Three, no, by that time, three kids. And yeah, I was Spice Dad, Old Spice, if anything. But at the time, they were calling the lads of Spice Boys. I wasn't included, so I kind of retrospectively been added to the list.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which, so you didn't spend your time partying with them or anything like that?
I didn't mind going out. But I mean, it's interesting, Jeff, because we look at football now. I mean, I got the tube the other day. Declan Rice is advertising some kind of, I don't know if it was skincare or whatever. And I'm thinking, yeah, that wasn't happening in the 90s until the likes of us at Liverpool were out there sort of promoting, I say promoting ourselves, I think enjoying the new stardom that the Premier League had brought. And again, a bit like Robbie Fowler missing a penalty, it's kind of, we were doing something which wasn't considered right at the time, but in the long run, it's actually become normalised.
Yeah.
We enjoyed our football. We enjoyed being footballers. Of course, a lot of players went out back in that era.
I mean, you went off and did a bit of modelling in the days when footballers didn't do that type of thing, really.
Yeah, by chance. I mean, Stan had signed for Liverpool, a men's fashion magazine had asked to do a photo shoot with me and Stan with blonde hair. Stan, I think there was fog in Cannock, so he didn't turn up for the shoot. And the guy said, you do it on your own. So I did it. I thought it was a bit of fun. And from that, the photographer, Norman Watson, he was asked by Armani to do some photos for a campaign. And I said, all right, why not? I never thought I was going to do modelling. It was literally 2 days, one doing the photo campaign and one doing a catwalk. But for some reason, it was assumed that I was out every day doing modelling. But yeah, it was a bit of fun.
Did you enjoyed it then, yeah?
Kind of. I was actually embarrassed, Jeff. I'm doing a catwalk in Milan at Giorgio Armani's house. And I've kind of walked down a catwalk, just a one-way thing, not the turnaround at the end. And when I got to the other end, there's a guy there with a six-pack. He was chiseled, and I thought, I need some of them. So I was the least modelly looking model there. So it was a bit of fun, you know, but it didn't last long.
Yeah. See, I look back at your career. We talk about modelling and talk about turning out in front of 50, 60,000 people every single week, you know, more when you're playing for England, obviously. And you think, well, you've got to be a really outgoing, sort of extrovert type of guy. But I sort of think you weren't like that, were you? You're
no.
Quite private.
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm talking about the modelling. I didn't do it for attention. I did it because it was something I thought I'd never do before. I think it, especially in a modern era now where a lot of people want to tell everybody about what they're up to. I, even on my social media, I keep my stuff private. I didn't want people to know too much, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I played football. That was it. I wasn't anything else, except for a model occasionally. But yeah, it's the way you let the more extrovert players do their extrovert thing. That was my kind of mentality.
Yeah. Was that difficult in a sort of football crazy city like Liverpool to be private?
Yeah, no, it was fine in Liverpool. I mean, the problem with Liverpool or playing for a club the size of Liverpool is that they're really only interested in your football. And for the 7 years I was there, we didn't win enough. So there was a lot of frustration in that sense. But yeah, with the my visits into Liverpool, especially during the daytime, kind of ended in the first season I was there, walking down Liverpool High Street and having Evertonian shout abuse at you. Friendly banter, I think it would be called. It was kind of, I can't be walking my kids around here. So then you end up becoming a little bit more reclusive, if you like.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Was it a big culture shock moving from, you know, a club like Watford to a club like Liverpool?
Everything was a shock. I grew up as a kid at Watford from 13 through to 21. Loved every moment that I was at Watford, pretty much. It was my family, and I was never a real football geek. I love numbers, but I didn't really follow superstars or even look at leagues half the time. I just enjoyed playing the game. and to go to Liverpool and kind of have a Watford mentality at a bigger club, and I knew they were bigger, of course, it didn't take too long to realise that it was nothing that I'd ever expected it to be. So, yes, it was a cold shock. I didn't drink before I went to Liverpool. A few of the players at Liverpool like to drink, so I kind of adopted their stance on things. And, you know, for a couple of years, I think it was difficult to really get back to being me, which I managed to do after a couple of years, and then getting the first team and started playing better football. So, yeah.
You say you didn't win enough at Liverpool. I think you won the League Cup there, didn't you?
That's not enough.
It's not enough, no. Was that one of the reasons why at times you got a bad press? Because obviously you know the nickname as well as I do. You know, you were nicknamed Calamity James. How you must have had to have very broad shoulders or thick skin to accept criticism like that.
I didn't accept it. No, I think the people who are aiming the criticism at me didn't. You've spoke to enough footballers to know that a lot of people who talk about football don't fully understand, especially when it comes to goalkeeping, the nuances in performing a goal. That bit doesn't actually matter because they're not necessarily talking to me. They're talking to a wider audience, and that's just an opinion. What I couldn't deal with was understanding why I wasn't, in particular instances, performing the way I should have been. And I think this is I'd learned a lesson, not just in football, but in life. I mean, communication with the people that you work with is key. And I didn't have that communication level. So I was getting frustrated by not doing what I should have been doing, not being able to talk to the people who should have been with me, helping me. And then to add another layer to that, you've got a media who are abusing you in certain ways, publicly, which then causes the public to think the same thing. And it was, you know, the Calamity James thing was being echoed quite often. So that was my frustration. Once I got an understanding of why I wasn't performing at the level I was meant to be performing, then I was better equipped to deal with them.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, that communication issue with your colleagues, you can put that right. But how do you put that relationship with the media, right? Did you have anything to do with them? Did you respond in any way? Did you care?
First of all, I stopped reading newspapers. I want to say I fell out with a lot of journalists. I just didn't have time for them. The problem that I had was that being friends with these guys and then all of a sudden them having to do what they needed to do in order to maintain their job meant that they weren't, you know, how can I put it? They were quite happy to throw you under the bus.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's kind of right, well, you've got to do what you've got to do. I don't need to be part of it.
So you blocked them completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because a lot of people who work in our industry are nice people generally, but they have a job to do. And at that time, their job was quite often talking badly about me.
Yeah. I think one thing that people can never quite relate to in most normal everyday jobs is that you wake up one morning and open a newspaper, or in your case, it's probably on the back page, and there'll be some story which is very uncomplimentary about you. Mm. And that mentally must be really hard to cope with.
Yeah, well, as I say, my frustration was not understanding why these things were going on. And I was fortunate when I was at Liverpool that the club doctor, Dr. Waller, introduced me to someone who I had a chat with. He came around my house. We had a couple of hours in my kitchen. And at the end of the 2 hours, it was kind of like, okay, now I get it, without going into too much detail of what we were talking about. But the interesting now, the sort of looking back at it, and especially the way our media works, and this is not making it good or bad, is anyone listening to this who works in an industry where they might not be in the headlines as an individual, their industry will be at some point. And when their industry is in the headlines, everyone who knows them will ask them the same questions about the headlines. And it's kind of like this is not just a football thing. So if you're in, my family were big in the NHS with nurses, doctors, whatever their employment was. As soon as something is mentioned about the NHS, then anyone who works for the NHS is tarred by the same brush. So it kind of, it can be relatable to a point.
Yeah. So the guy came to see you, was he a psychologist then?
I don't know.
Oh, right, okay.
I thought he was when he came, but I didn't realise that he wasn't when he left. Yeah. So, but it was perfect. My analogy was the park bench. You know, you sat, not that I've ever done this, but you've heard stories of people sat on a park bench talking to a stranger, and that conversation kind of lifts a lot of weight off the shoulders. Well, this guy left, and I was like, well, okay, good. And I thanked the doctor, said to him, that psychologist, and he went, he wasn't a psychologist. So I was like, okay, fine. It works.
Yeah. And of course, it's something I think a lot of people, well, in every walk of life, but in football and sport, a lot of people do that now. But I guess then it was much less common.
Yeah. I think socially, you know, the idea of men sharing their thoughts or negative thoughts, should I say, with someone else wasn't seen as the way to do things. Football definitely. Mm. You know, the idea, even mentioning, and this is why the doc was my hero. I had quite loudly mentioned sports psychology in a changing room, and he pulled me one side and said, the club don't like it, but I know a man. So it was kind of like, okay, I was crying out for help. Even though I didn't realise at the time, and the doc was receptive to that and helped me out. So yeah, football, you had to be thick-skinned, broad-shouldered, you know, take it and move on. That was basically the advice I was getting when things weren't going well. And in my head, it was like, that isn't what I need to hear, but I didn't know what I needed to hear at the time. Whereas now, fortunately, as you say, in every walk of life, we are encouraged as men, as people, to have conversations. And, you know, I use the park bench analogy. Sometimes just a simple conversation can change your whole view on things.
Really interesting stuff. I remember Paul Merson telling me once that, you know, before he took penalty in the World Cup finals, you know, in those days, he said, you might not have wanted to take a penalty, and I don't think he did. He said, but it wasn't the sort of thing you could ever say in front of your teammates, I'm not up for this, boys. You know, no. I'm afraid of this. Could never do it.
No. And then that was the thing, is you're right. Yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah. Look, just before we get back into it, we've got another cracking prize for you today. It's a real beauty. Over at OLBG Prizes, we're giving you the chance to win a signed David James England shirt. It's a Navy 2006 to 2008 Umbro goalkeeper shirt. Not the striker's shirt. The goalkeeper's shirt, hand signed by the man himself, who sat right across from me today. Proper collector's item. Here's the best bit. Completely free to enter. It'll take you all of 30 seconds. No catch. No cost at all. Just get your name in the hat. So head to olbgprizes.com/Stelling. Get your entry in right now. It could be yours. And while you're there, keep an eye out. Plenty of more signed shirts to be won from guests that we've had on the show, including the Liverpool and Pompey shirt signed by JMO himself. So that's olbgprizes.com/Stelling. Good luck. Give it a go. Absolutely nothing to lose. 18 plus, free entry routes available. T's and C's apply. Let's talk about your England career, David, because, you know, more than 50 caps. Jordan Pickford's a sort of automatic choice for England these days. I looked through some of the English goalkeepers who've been around during your career. I had to write them down because the list is so long. David Seaman, Paul Robinson, Nigel Martin, Chris Kirtland, Ben Foster, Scott Carson, Rob Green, Richard Wright, Tom Heaton, Richard Lee, Ian Walker, Nicky Weaver. Goodness me. Mm. Very different to today. So achieve 50-plus caps with that sort of competition is amazing.
Yeah, and I lost a few times as well. Yeah, I mean, 13 years, I think, from my debut to my last game. And because I like numbers, the way I look at it, it wasn't enough. You know, it's less than, was it, 4.5 a year, something like that. And you kind of think, what went wrong for it only to be 4.5 games a year? I got in, and again, this is slightly ironic that my debut was at a time when I wasn't playing well for Liverpool. Mm-hmm. So I thank Glenn Hoddle for trusting in me. Yeah, I know it was a friendly against Mexico, and it didn't mean anything in a lot of different ways, but he gave me an opportunity to play. I don't know if it was because he thought that might get me out of a slump or whatever, but I didn't play for 3 years after that. I was 30 when I made my second appearance.
Wow.
Yeah,
so, who was the manager then?
It was Pete Taylor.
Right.
He was interim manager for Sven, and we played Italy away. I broke my nose at Goodison Park on the, I think it was a Saturday, before we met up with England squad. It might have been a Wednesday game, actually. I broke my nose, and the question was, do I miss England to get my nose fixed? Or do I play for England and don't do any modelling anymore? And I thought, do you know what? It's all about England. So I excuse the pun, but I cracked on, played that game. And then it was all right then. I was kind of in the England squad properly. Although I didn't play in any qualifiers straight away. Sven took over. Dave was playing. Obviously, we had World Cup 2002, all that stuff. Then got the kind of number one spot. Did all right, made some mistakes, lost my place to Robbo. Sort of fought back, got in it again. Lost my place again, fought back, got in again. And yeah, it wasn't the easiest ride. But the one thing I sort of look back in, I didn't think about it at the time, but the one thing, looking back at it, and you mentioned Jordan there. I mean, he's been England's number one now for what? 6-7 years. I can't think of many England goalkeepers who were number one, bombed, and then kind of got back to being number one again. So I quietly pat myself on the back for being stubborn.
I think in Steve McLaren's days in charge, then he sort of liked to rotate goalkeepers, didn't he? If not the starting keeper, but certainly the keepers on the bench.
Not me.
Not you.
No, he dropped me.
He dropped you, yeah.
Yeah. Before I signed for Portsmouth, he phoned me up and politely told me that he knew how good I was and he wanted to look at other goalkeepers. And anyone who's been told that excuse knows that they think that you're crap. So I politely thanked him and wished him all the best. And he, I think at the same time as myself, Dave Beckham and Sol Campbell had got bombed. And he invited us back for the Croatia or pre-Croatia game.
Which turned out to be a pivotal game, didn't it? This is the qualifying game that Scott Carson played in.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually the Russia, I think it was Russia away that we got called back in the squad, but Dave played in the Croatia game. I'm not sure if Dave was in the Russia game, actually, because I seem to remember him coming on against Croatia, putting in two crosses. We scored off one of them. It was a joke, but when Nico Crancho was lining up that shot as my teammate, I was, I know what you're going to do now. And he did it and he scored and we were out. And you just think, okay, I say we deserve this. I think we deserved it because we had the wrong manager.
I mean, I think that Scott Carson only won four England caps in the future. Did the criticism that he took for his part in England failing to qualify for the Euros, was the Euros, wasn't it? Did the criticism that he took, did that affect his career? It must have done.
Difficult to say. I mean, I go back to my point. That, I was dropped and then back in, dropped back in. I persevered and I just wanted to play for England, but also just, there was part of me to say stubborn or foolish enough not to worry about things too much. Scotty was a tremendous goalkeeper. Really, really was. I had so much talent. And he was up against, arguably me, in a short period of time. Robbo, who established himself as a number one, Rob Green. So all the arguments that were faced with me as competition, he had them as well. The problem with the Croatia game was that I think Scotty had been brought in the game before against Poland, which was a 1-0. And I was sat on the bench against Russia as a number two. Then was on the bench against Poland for Scotty's game where I was number two, which kind of meant that I was number three in the same play. It was a weird thing. I was going through a whole range of mental emotions.
You were not a Steve McLaren fan, were you?
No, not at all. No, I haven't got a problem with not being played. I was frustrated, of course, which I was allowed to be. I didn't have a problem. I just didn't like the reasoning. And I struggled even getting in the squad, back in the squad. I was kind of, the dynamics of the, we talk about Thomas Tuchel and the way he sets things up. There was a lot of things in that squad which didn't feel right. Not the players, but just the way things were set up. And then when you look at what happened, you can blame me because we lost against Russia and we lost against Croatia. And I'm not taking the blame for that, but it just didn't feel right. And we needed a change, which we got. And Fabio was good.
Yeah. So, yeah, you got your World Cup chance, 2010. No, I mean, not the first.
Only by chance.
Yeah, not the first game, only by chance.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. It's kind of...
Because Rob Green played the first game, didn't he?
Yeah. So we, if I could just quickly jump back to Steve McLaren. So he gives me this phone call pre-season. I think a couple of weeks before the season started. And the first five games at Portsmouth, I kept clean sheets. So I'm thinking, maybe there might be a little callback. And nothing happened. So effectively 18 months go by. And I'm thinking, I'm playing really well and I'm not getting called up. And when I did get called up, it was a surprise. Then obviously not to play under him. For Fabio to come in, I was thinking, all right, I'm out now because I'm 38 years old. You know, the other keepers, whoever they are, Rob Green, Robbo, whoever it would have been. And Fabio basically called me in and put me in as number one. I was like, okay, fine, right. And I was ready for it and we played the games. I had an injury. Playing for England, it hurts, right? Mentally, physically, everything. I basically ruptured tore my labrum in my shoulder in the Russia game warm-up. I didn't realise for 18 months. I had an X-ray on it or a scan on it, and I had to have surgery. I had a problem with my knee. I had to have surgery. So after starting with Fabio as number one, I said to him at the end of that first season, I need an operation. Any Portsmouth fan listening would contest that towards the end of the season, I was letting some funny goals in, but my shoulder just generally wouldn't function. So I had to have this operation. The rehab afterwards wasn't as good as it should have been for my knee, and I ended up spending a lot more time out and I was getting regular injuries. So Rob Green ended up being number one. No problem. I mean, this is the nature of football. So when we get to the World Cup squad, I've got a number one shirt. And the logic was that England number one shirt is going to start the World Cup. I played half a game against Japan, which was my 50th cap, which was nice. Joe Hart played the second half. He was fantastic. And then there was this question mark, who's going to play against the USA? And we didn't know. I can remember being on a bus and lads are talking. He's like, you playing, Jamie? Oh, I don't know. Oh, yeah, I've heard he thinks he's playing. But, and I was thinking, if I don't play, it's going to be Joe, because Joe was fantastic. And as Fabio had this thing, I used to call it deal or no deal, where you'd sit in the room before you get the bus, and he'd lift up the flip chart, and there was a team. So you're kind of trying to read through this piece of paper. Can I see? And it's the USA game. Chart goes up. Rob Green's playing. And for, I think, about a minute and a half, I was spitting feathers. Not because it was Rob, it was just I thought I was going to be playing. So effectively, I wasn't going to play in the World Cup. And these dynamics, Jeff, where you want to do what you want to do best because it's your career, but you're part of a team and the team has to do what the team has to do best because that's more important, you know, the needs of the many and all that stuff. I wanted to play and I wasn't. So for a minute and a half, I'm like, ugh. Anyway. The unfortunate incident with Rob and Dempsey meant that US won all in the end. And the game against Algeria, the flip chart goes up. James is on there. So I get to play my debut in a World Cup at 39 years old. And it's kind of one of those bittersweet moments where you're thinking, yes. Okay, we draw 0-0. Terrible game. Another one of my teammates, Belhaj, was sensational. Mark Jarren Lennon out of the game. We come off the field having drawn two games now. So it's all up against Slovenia, I think it was, in the third leg. And this is where the team and the individual sort of needs and wants are challenged, because had Rob Green kept a clean sheet against the US, we'd have won. I would never have played in the World Cup. In that version of a story, we could have won the World Cup. And in that version, I would have been the goalie who never played in a World Cup winning squad. Well, I'd rather be sat here now having that conversation with you than being the one who did play and got knocked out.
Well, would you?
Well, no, because I'm buzzing over the fact I played. Yeah, but we never won. So it's kind of... There's
could have been a sliding doors moment, though.
Yeah. But this is, and I think it's all interlinked when I go back to the Liverpool thing. A lot of my frustration is I should have done something different. But difference doesn't mean it's always good. And I sort of sit here now and I think, yeah, okay, I played the game. It happened the way it happened. There is a version, another parallel universe where Rob makes a save and we end up winning the World Cup. Actually, you wouldn't have me here. You'd have Rob here. But anyway.
But is it fair to say, and maybe it's the case for every goalkeeper, it probably is, you did not take conceding goals well. So if you've won a game,
how many times in your career as a presenter have you said, oh, the goalkeeper would be disappointed with that?
Yeah, for you. Yeah.
Can you think of any goal that you've seen a goalie let in and the goalie and said, oh, the goalie would be really happy with that one? It doesn't happen.
Yeah. I know, but if you've won the game, you know, if you've won the game and you know, let's say when you're playing for Liverpool, you've won the game, but you've made a mistake and conceded a goal.
Hmm.
Does that ruin your weekend?
I was, and again, this is not a... I can look at it now and sort of understand why it was and also understand how bad it was. But I was not happy with conceding a goal, period. We could win 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. I would be very unhappy with the fact that I let a goal in, to the point that I wouldn't talk to people. And what I didn't realise at the time is that my, and again, this goes back to the team and individual needs and wants, my need, I felt, and what I wanted to do was keep clean sheets, and that justified my value. And if we scored 5, that's fine, because we've got the players who can score 5, but my value was keeping clean sheets. So winning 5-1 meant that I had a bad game. But it got to the point, Jeff, where we're winning 4-0, and I've had 2 goal kicks, and I'm walking off the field, and, oh, well played, Jim. I'm like, what, I had 2 goal kicks? That was it. And I was getting frustrated with not having contributed. I looked at it in a very simplistic way. I get paid to play football, and I train hard to play football in a certain way where I make loads of saves and do all this stuff. If I walk off the field on a Saturday and I haven't done anything, then I haven't justified being paid. Not that I was going to give any money back, but it's kind of, I've worked to be the best and I didn't get to do it. And that frustrated me.
Yeah.
And when I got older, I realised that, do you know, sometimes it's nice when you keep a clean sheet and don't have a lot to do.
Yeah. Do you think all goalkeepers are the same? Was this just you, or do you think all goalkeepers are the same?
They're not the same. I think there's obviously a lot of crossover. Some of them are just different in a good way.
Yeah.
Mm.
So look, you kept a clean sheet against Algeria, and you know big, your relationship big, with the media?
Job, the best clean sheet ever. Go on.
That was...
I'm joking. No. It was the worst game ever.
Was it?
I'll tell you what.
Well, I tell you, look, I tell you, you can tell us one story, but there's another story, because the Guardian headline from that day says, James brings sure touch to England's ragged ranks. You know, the arch enemy of the press, and they said you brought sure touch to the England defence.
And I apologise for the way that I phrased it before. I'm not a big fan of generalisms, but the media was essentially... 4 or 5 newspapers at the time. That's how I viewed it. I used to do columns for The Guardian. Maybe that's why they put a nice word.
Yeah. Well, the byline was written by David James, actually.
No. I mean, it wasn't everything was negative, but obviously you sort of get impacted by it. I didn't do a lot in that game. It wasn't a very good game of football. It was one of the worst games of football. And I've met England fans who were at the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, clean sheet. Shouldn't.
Yeah, but and again, Joe, I've said it's funny because I would have rather won 5-4. I probably wouldn't have played the next game, but it's kind of, you'd have rather won 5-4, got three points, and we wouldn't have ended up playing Germany. I think we would have played Ghana, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember how the draw worked out. We would have topped the group instead of the USA. So we would have arguably been in a better position to win the World Cup that year.
We've got a shot here. You're resplendent in your England gear there. I tell you what, I look at some of the faces in that squad. Oh, my goodness. You know, how did we not win anything?
Because there are other teams were allowed to be better than us.
Allowed to be better?
Yes, it's a game. Yeah. You know, and sometimes the opposition are pretty good.
Was it with the use of the word allowed? You know, does that mean it was down to the sort of the tactical master plan from whoever was in charge at the time?
There are moments. I mean, I think one of the frustrations that I have now is where we were the golden generations. And it's said in a way, is like, and you mentioned the players there. There's no question that these players are exceptional. And that generation, I think the golden generation has morphed now into the 90s even. Yeah. It's become bigger. It's a bit like Spice.
Is that squad better than the England squad at this World Cup?
Those players at their best versus the current England squad at their best. I think technically this squad are better than us. Without doubt. But have they got the game plan? Well, arguably, yeah. I mean, they got to two Euro finals. I mean, if we extend the squad over a few years. But the difference, I think, the sort of going back to that golden generation is that we only got to quarterfinals, I think, maybe, I can't remember, semi-final back in the 90s, which I wasn't involved in. These guys are playing in finals. We still had to, first of all, we needed a bit of luck to get through that quarterfinal. We then had a semi-final. We then had another final. So all of a sudden, it's like we're three sort of connections away from success. You know, England in 2020 were two penalties away from success. So they've achieved a lot more than what we did. We were very, very good, but we came up against, on occasions, exceptionally better teams. A bit of luck. I mean, as I say, when you look at Portugal 2004, a bit of luck one way or another. We score, you look at Germany 2010, if Frank's goal goes in, it makes it 2-2, which means we haven't won.
But if it goes in?
If it's counted, sorry, forgive me. Yeah. Goal line technology, because of Frank. Yeah. I mean, the one thing I've been involved in some games which have had some impacts on the rest of world football, if it's Robbie Fowler missing penalties or Frank not scoring a goal, which he should have scored. But we came up against better teams, and I rest at night, Jeff, with the thought that had we beaten Portugal, we could have ended up losing to Greece in the final. And there's a bit about me when Ronaldo's Portugal side beat you in a penalty shootout. It's an easy conversation 20 years later than it is you lost to that Greece side 1-0 in the final, or Germany or Ghana. It's kind of
You think Greece were fated to win it that year?
They did everything that they needed to do to win that Euros, and I applaud them for it.
That was one of the most astonishing Euros ever in terms of results. It wasn't great in terms of entertainment, you know, unless you were Greek, but it didn't matter because they got the results.
I played a charity match against those guys a couple of years ago. They're all really happy. they could smile at me and they could, They did what they needed to do.
Yeah. How do you think goalkeeping's changed over the years? Has it changed at all?
I think the rule changes obviously create a different need from goalkeeping. I mean, I sort of aging myself here, but the back pass rule. I mean, no one even talks about it now unless they're asking about the changes in goalkeeping, but the back pass rule was fundamental. So you had to be able to control the ball and do things like that, which you didn't necessarily need to do before. I think with the change of the goal kick rule, you know, starting inside the box or being able to play inside the box meant that goalkeepers required better skills. The idea of good with his feet, and another cliche which really frustrates me, you just need to be able to control the ball and pass it to one of your teammates. That doesn't necessarily mean you're exceptional with your feet. It just means you can control the ball and pass it to a teammate. There's a lot more required in that sense to take risk, hence the reason we see so many more mistakes from goalkeepers. But there's almost an acceptance that we'd rather that happen every now and again than not have possession and then score more goals. I think in the simplistic way, that's the way it pans out. When it comes to the actual bit about goalkeeping stopping shots, I don't think a lot has changed. Yes, you know, Schmeichel-esque handballed star dives have become a thing over generations. That's morphed into different styles of doing that. But I mean, that's Schmeichel. We're talking 20 years ago. So if we're still doing what he was doing, and this is why I think Pete was one of the greatest goalkeepers ever. He did something which fundamentally changed the way that goalkeepers kept goal in football. Even if he hijacked it from handball, it's kind of everybody started doing it. So beyond that, no. Yeah. Which is frustrating because I've started my, or nearly finished my goalkeeping coaching badges because I can't understand why I'm not seeing a difference. The idea of goalkeepers saving top corner shots, and in your illustrious career as a presenter, you would have commented on goalkeepers making top corner saves. It doesn't happen as often now. I don't know why. I've got an idea, but I don't know why. And it's kind of, are we stopping goalkeepers from doing what they fundamentally should be able to do, which is stop the ball from going in the back of the net, and creating ones who are more part of a build-up?
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, we'll win 5-4 rather than going back to the clean sheets. Now, that's, for me...
Are we blinkered in that view? I mean, are we blinkered into thinking that we've got to play out from the back? You know, is the balance of risk and reward right?
Well, the best teams generally win, like they all have, always have done. There seems to be more goals being scored, so the care for clean sheets is lessened. Again, slightly ironic, is that Arsenal end up winning the title with solid defence at the end of the season. That's one thing Arteta did say early on in the season, which I was ready to argue against. You know, in the end, their defence probably won that title because they were able to win 1-0. I know goals win games, but they were able to stop David Raya from being exposed. So the best teams can play out the back and they can defend and they can do all those things. I think there's just a part where coaching works if you play out the back. It doesn't work if you play long. And a lot of the coaches that we have in football now have sort of come through a system where it's all play out the back. So I can't see anything changing anytime soon, but there will be a change at some point. And long kicks will be back in fashion, Jeff, just like your shorts.
I'm not sure these levels are back in fashion.
I'm jealous, I'm jealous.
Long throws, I mean, you know, you've seen long throws and, you know, things have come around again. You said Peter Schmeichel, one of the greatest ever.
Mm.
Yeah. Have you got a view on who the greatest ever was?
I should be saying an English goalkeeper here.
No, you don't have to.
No, I should be because I was brought up with English goalkeeping is the best standard of goalkeeping. I think the best, and what I love about football is I can give you loads of numbers and describe the best goalkeeper or player based on numbers. And someone will argue me, no, someone else is better. And I take the numbers out of it. Buffon, for me, was the best.
Mm.
I remember I was playing at the time and I saw a video of him as a teenager for Parma, save the first Ronaldo's penalty for Inter. And the ball is still in play. And he runs behind the goal and starts celebrating with the Parma fans. And I thought, who is this kid? I love him.
Mm.
And then, I mean, what a career he had as a player. What an ability he had as a goalkeeper. I've met him on a number of occasions. And he is one of the loveliest guys as well. So he's my best. And I can get numbers to get someone else as number one. But you can't beat...
You don't think it always comes down to numbers, does it? You know, I mean, unfortunately, I go back a lot further than you, David, and I don't have your goalkeeping expertise, but for me, you know, I can never forget the Gordon Banks save from Pelé, you know, in the World Cup finals. And that, for me, I don't care what his figures were like, that catapults him right to the top
and
of the pile.
And it did for me.
Yeah.
Because the first time I saw that, it was unbelievable. It was the best save in the world. Yeah. It literally was the best save in the world. And as an Englishman or an English kid at the time, being sort of taught by English goalkeeping coaches, and that would ever come up, then Gordon Banks, great save in the world. Gregory Coupe makes a better save for Marseille in the Champions League, I think 1990, when there was a, or 92 when a back pass, talk about the back pass rule, defender back pass, he has to run back, he heads it onto the crossbar, it comes back out and he gets up and makes a save against Barcelona. Technically, it was a better save than Gordon Banks. But Banks, he, you know,
yeah,
England's greatest ever goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And he was pivotal in England's success in 66 throughout the group stages and knockouts for the for that World Cup. So, you know, Banksy was up there. And I was reliably informed by my goalie coach who said, yeah, Banksy was different class. So
lovely memories. Look, I want to come at your club career in a moment, but just before we do, if you're enjoying this, and I do hope that you are, do us a favour, subscribe to the YouTube channel. It genuinely does help us out. It means you won't miss a thing. We've got some cracking guests lined up for you over the next few weeks as well. Some proper names, some brilliant stories too. One or two conversations I think will surprise you. So hit subscribe, tap the little bell so YouTube tells you just when we're back, and we'll see you for the next one. So David, club managers, goodness me, there was a list of them. Colin Lee. Was Colin Lee your first manager?
I made my debut at Watford, yeah.
And then Souness, Evans, John Gregory, Glenn Roeder, Alan Pardew, Kevin Keegan, Stuart Pearce, Harry Redknapp, Tony Adams, Paul Hart, Avram Grant. Goodness me, that's a list. Who did he get on with and who didn't you get on with out of them?
I got on with everyone, I think. Yeah. I think the one I got on the best with was probably H.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not a surprise, is it?
Yeah, I love H. I mean, he at 36 years old when I signed for Portsmouth, he was part of a setup which allowed me to get back in the England squad. And that wasn't the intention when I signed for Portsmouth. It was to avoid relegation, which we handsomely did for at least a couple of seasons. But H was, he was a straight talker. Yeah, I was told what I needed to hear, so he was a straight talker. His environment that he created got me playing my best football.
Yeah, and we were obviously FA Cup winner with Portsmouth as well.
What there a day.
Go. Yeah. That was a good team, wasn't it? I was looking back at it with Sol Campbell, Nico Crankyar, you mentioned already in the side, Pedro Mendes, Kanu. It was a proper good side.
Jono, yeah, Herman. Yeah. I mean, we should have won the cup final. I don't think that's a question. We should have won the semi-final. It was a bizarre cup run. I mean, we had six games, 5 1-0s, 1-2-1, one home game, which was 2-1, one Premier League side, which was Man United away. Really, we should have won it. And the thing is, Jeff, for the joy of winning the FA Cup, and I'd previously lost two or before that, and it was kind of like a moment of relief, if you like, that I could actually get to a final and win the FA Cup. But it was the following day down at Southsea where the report is 200,000. But it was like something I'd never witnessed before, obviously on a football level. But the whole of the Southsea community, the Portsmouth Island community, had turned up to celebrate us winning. And what that meant to me was that this football club means something to the community, and where you can have successful clubs in communities and everyone loves the fact they keep winning. This was a side that had won something who don't normally win. In fact, I think it was the FA Cup back during the war the last time they won that. But the love for Portsmouth Football Club is deep-rooted in that community, and we were representing that community when we won the trophy, not just the football team. So that was the moment that it actually kind of hit home that this was special.
Yeah. I mean, you played a lot of great grounds, obviously. Fratton Park, we all know what it's like. Was it special playing at Fratton Park? Because I'm not the biggest crowd, not in comparison to some of the clubs that you play for, but oh my goodness, they make a noise, don't they?
Yeah, it was. I think when I look at my career, especially being Portsmouth being the last Premier League club, it was almost like a bookend to Watford. in many different ways. I mean, it was a smaller stadium in one sense, but it felt like a family club. And I know this term gets chucked around a lot, but if where I was at Watford, and I was part of that family, I came to Portsmouth, and I was introduced to this community and family. I felt at home there. We were getting changed in porter cabins. It was as far from the Premier League as you would expect it to be in so many different ways, even though they'd been there for a few years. Rented a training ground, all these things which were sort of dear to me. The Fratton Park, I mean, it had a hill in each goal, which was like a throwback to the 80s and 90s. It was kind of the decades. I reckon if the archaeologists had been in there, probably find a shoelace from the 1800s, 1900s, whatever. The rickety ground, I think the stand was 100 years old. All these things, it was kind of like the fabric of Portsmouth was in that stadium. And teams did not like playing us there.
Yeah,
it was great. And then they put a roof on the end, and it was kind of like, hang on, we're getting modernised. It was.
I mean, and Harry and Jim Smith just seemed like they seemed the perfect fit for Portsmouth in some way. I don't know.
I know there's some people listening who might have other views on what was going on. But anyway, my time there was.
But why would they?
I don't know. I mean, winning the FA Cup and then going into administration 2 years later. There was a lot of. I mean, it wasn't all roses. But as I say, I still go down to Portsmouth during the seasons, and I love my time down there.
Yeah. Did you decide to finish, or did it just happen?
Playing?
In terms, yeah.
I went from Portsmouth to, I mean, I have to mention Bristol City for 2 years, which wasn't particularly good from me, because I physically wasn't capable of doing what I needed to do. 6 months at Bournemouth, where I was managed by Eddie Howe for a period, which was sensational. Went out to Iceland with my Portsmouth teammate Herman, which was sensational, and then went to India. And I was playing manager in India, and we played a final.
We got a picture of you out there.
Yeah. The
Kerala Blasters, yeah?
Yeah, look at that, what team. We played the final against, I think we played the final against Goa. Was it Goa? No, Atletico, Kolkata, Blimey, I forgot. Okay. Conceded a goal in the 92nd minute, lost 1-0. And I remember they're getting all the celebrations ready, and I was sat on the dugout, and I sat there and said to myself, that's it. That's it. Done. And that was, I kind of decided, I physically was challenged, of course. My knee wasn't good and stuff. I was 43 years old, but I realised that I didn't have what was needed to try and compete, as opposed to whether I could compete or not. I just didn't have it anymore. So I kind of, that was it, finished.
And how did he cope with that after such a long time in the game?
I think the fact that I had the injuries made it easier. yeah, he says. And what makes me laugh, Jeff, is I look back at what I did after, kind of, you know, weird things like growing beards and stuff like that, which wasn't my thing. It was kind of, I think there was...
A lot of people have beards, you know. It's not that
weird. No. Yeah, but there's things that you look at and you go, oh, my friends were laughing at me about a tash I had while I was in India. But anyway, I look back and I think, yeah, there was the wobble. Well, at the time, I didn't think there was a problem. I was used to playing football, but because of the injuries, I knew that I couldn't do, and it was frustrating not being able to do what I could do before. So there's a part where you go, okay, yeah, but I can't do it. And I think if I could, then I would have been in a worse position, because I would have thought I could still get out there and do it. And then it would have been someone else. It's all about control, isn't it? Someone else not allowing me to do it. With the injuries, I've got half an excuse that I had control, or ironically, the lack of control. But it kind of stopped me. Yeah, I even think about it now. I see, well, I could have done that. But then I go out there and run around for a bit, and I'm thinking, maybe I can't.
Of course, you went back to India, didn't you? Back to Kerala as well. As
a manager, yeah.
So what was sort of daily life like there?
I loved my two spells in India. Absolutely loved them for many different reasons. When I went in as a manager, so I was player manager the first time for a few months. When I went in as a full-time manager, I kind of went with a different mindset. First of all, I wasn't playing, so I didn't have to, didn't have to choose whether I was playing or not. But I tried to empower the people I was with, because people are kind of siloed off as a physio, as a doctor or a sports, whatever it is. And I just thought, I read a lot of books on management. I just thought, we have an opportunity here where my physio could learn something else if he wants to. And they would come to me and say, oh, I want to do a thing on raking or scraping, whatever it was. And I'm like, when is it? It's a week in Mumbai. Okay, speak to the medical team. If we can create a scenario, we haven't got any injuries, you can go for a week and you can get your whatever diploma in this thing. And that was, I wanted to manage rather than coach. And we didn't have a good season. And in the end, it just didn't work out. But I felt that I was trying to help everybody, or at least create an environment where people were happy to be working there. Because sometimes it's just about football. It's just about results. But in reality, it's always about people who happen to be involved in football. So it was trying to create that environment. And I came back, and in the end, it went really sour. And I kind of got back home and I was like, do you know what? Would I do it again? During lockdown, I applied for loads and loads of jobs. I think four times I got a reply. Excuse me. I don't think it was me though. I think it was more the fact that the system is kind of loaded one way or the other. And this isn't being critical. I think if a job becomes available, then the reason that's available is because they know who's going to take it. And when you're putting CVs in and not getting responses,
so are we talking about the system in this country?
I just think football's the same. I mean, if you've got any kind of succession planning, then you kind of know who's going to be next.
Yeah,
you don't just sack someone and hope that someone turns up. I think there's a good idea who you know. So as soon as a vacancy comes in, you put an application in. The thing that bothered me was that people were just rude and not replying. Even a thanks but no thanks would have been right.
Yeah,
but just. Yeah, en masse, it was kind of like, might as well not written. But anyway.
My son's looking for a job. He's written 70 applications and he's had one reply.
In a day where AI, even if it was an AI reply, you just go, right, at least they've recognised I've sent something.
Yeah.
So I mentioned it before about the goalkeeping coaching. There's a lot more that can be done to, I think, I don't want to say Craig, sounds wrong, to enhance what physical, mental attributes goalkeepers have.
Yeah.
So we could have a different form and conversations about who's the best. I'd like to think that the best is still to come.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, you're a student of the game, you know. Do you still feel that you can have a role within the English game?
Absolutely, yeah. But I also feel that I don't think anyone would want me to help them. I say anyone. Yeah, it's a weird scenario because, again, we have, and I suppose this is like any industry, we have people who are in control of certain departments or certain areas and they're kind of precious about being in control. And if you offer them a challenge, then, or maybe an alternative way of looking at it, they're less likely to take it on board because it's not theirs. So I'm getting the qualifications and when the opportunity arises, then I will see where I can use them.
Yeah. It's amazing because it's such a glittering career, and yet it seems such a battle to remain involved and to an outsider. And I'm an outsider, you know. As you're scratching your head, why we don't make use of people's experience?
But the thing is, yeah, I'm not unique in this, and I think for outfield players, I mean, we mentioned Ashley Cole there. I mean, he had to go out to Italy to get his first job, and you're thinking, 100 caps. Qualify, he's got all the qualifications, he's been working with the under-21s, England under-21s. I mean, why isn't this guy getting a job? He's a bit panicky, what's the word? I can't remember the word. he wants a specific role in a specific club, whatever, that's fine, that's his choice. But it's kind of, I'm not actively looking for a job, so I can't say the system or the industry has turned its back on me. I'm just looking at how I would enter into this market. And it wouldn't just be in a traditional, I'll be a goalie coach way, because I can't do that.
Yeah.
Why
can't you do that?
Because I was a goalkeeper. And I know the role of the goalie coach. And I Yeah, I love people. But I know myself. I've told you, I know myself. The idea of going in, day out for a whole year, can't let's do some of this, some of that. That would do my head in. It'd be more of an advisory role, I think. I wouldn't want to kick any balls at anyone. I couldn't see the point. I can't kick the ball hard as outfield players, whatever. Yeah.
So watch this space.
I'm not blaming the industry for this, no. Jeff, at all. I know myself well enough.
Oh, look, David, I've absolutely loved this. Absolutely. We're out of time, but I've loved it. So thanks very much indeed for your company.
Yeah.
You've been watching the Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG. Do join us again next time if you possibly can.